Welcome to Laudio. I'm Linda McQueen. Today our guest is Ryan Williams. He'll be speaking to us all the way from Albuquerque in New Mexico. Our topic today is a difficult one. It's about child sexual abuse in the church, in our church. Ryan is a survivor of abuse in our church. So this podcast comes with a trigger warning. If you think this subject might bring to the surface strong feelings or emotions that you aren't ready or able to deal with just yet, you might want to consider stopping listening now. So, Ryan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It means so much to us. First of all, let's find out a little bit about you. You're living in Albuquerque, New Mexico. That's a long way from Australia. So what's the story behind that?
Yeah, so I grew up in Adelaide, South Australia, and spent the first 26 years of my life in Australia, spent some time in Alice Springs, became a Christian while I was up in Alice Springs as a young man, and then felt called to ministry. And so I started doing some seminary studies, and an opportunity came up to study in the US in Seattle, which is in Washington State, which is kind of in the northwest part of the US. And so I went over there and I was single and I was thinking, I'll just do a year out here studying and working in a church, and then I'll come back to Australia. And then I met my wife. And so that changed everything, because she was from the States, and we got married. We got two wonderful kids. I pastored a church in the Seattle area for about 8 years. And about 4 years ago, we felt like the Lord led us down here to Albuquerque to take on a replant of a church that had been struggling a little bit. And so here we are. We've been here for the last 4 years. Albuquerque, New Mexico is a lot like Central Australia in more ways than one. And so it actually feels kind of a lot like home for me.
Great story. It's amazing, isn't it, how God leads us to somewhere we might never have imagined. Now, would you tell us a little bit about your experiences here in Australia, and especially about the circumstances that led up to the abuse that happened to you?
So my family and I, when I was a kid, we went to a Lutheran church in South Australia, pretty standard suburban church. My family on my mum's side has been a part of the Lutheran church since people first settled South Australia. And so my grandparents, for example, are both in their 90s, and they have been members of one Lutheran church for their entire life. And so they continue to be a part of that. And so when my parents were raising us, my brother and I, it seemed pretty standard that we would find ourselves at a Lutheran church in South Australia. And we did. So we were members at a local church in Adelaide and really involved in the church, pretty deeply committed members. And mum and dad were serving, and our whole community was kind of surrounded by the church, and my brother and I went to the school that was attached to the church. And so kind of our whole lives were absolutely immersed in that community.
All this sounds like the most unlikely place for sexual abuse to happen to a child. Are you able to explain how this actually does happen right under the noses of ordinary church people?
Yeah. You know, so I was quite young. I was probably somewhere between 8 and 9 years old. And like I just said, this community was our entire life. It was a place that we felt extremely safe in. Our lives were just we knew everyone, you know, and everyone knew us. And there was a Sunday after church where here's how it usually would go. You know, church finishes, mom and dad go out and they start having coffee or tea with all of their friends and having a chat. And when you're a young kid, standing around listening to your parents talk doesn't sound like a lot of fun. And so myself and a few other kids found our way over to the playground that was attached to the school, but it was away from where all the adults were. And so we were playing out there, and, you know, just as a kid, you're not aware of the circumstances going on around you, but, you know, parents would come and get their kids as they were going home. Until it was just myself and a much older boy were left on the playground together. And it was kind of odd that he was there, because he was much older than the average kids that are out there on the playground. And the way I remember it, the moment that the last child left and went around the corner so that we were alone, the tone changed of what was going on. And this older boy, I remember him cornering me in a play structure on the playground. Kind of forced me back into the corner. I remember it was a wooden play structure. So I remember touching the the wood as I was kind of forced back into the corner. And then he kind of forced me to sit down and he kind of blocked my exit and began to talk about a lot of really sexual things. And then physically, sexually abused me there in the corner of that play structure. And there was a moment I remember where he kind of leaned over to the side and I saw like a gap, you know, like nothing sexual had ever happened to me before. You know, I was just a kid. I just was freaking out when it was happening. And he leaned over and I saw a little gap of where I thought, I think I can get out of here. And so kind of fight flight jumped in and I ran away. And so I was able to get past him. He tried to grab me as I went past him, and I was able to get out of the door to the play structure when there was like a play bridge across it. And I remember jumping off the play bridge as I ran away towards a car, and he yelled, he said, "Whatever you do, don't tell your mum or dad," and I ran back to the car. And I was utterly terrified. And, you know, I can't remember exactly how it went, but as I got to the car, I feel like my parents were coming to the car, and, you know, dad could tell I was pretty freaked out. And I remember we hopped in and he turned around, he looked me in the eye, said, "Are you okay?" And I lied to him. And it was the first time I remember actually lying to my dad. And I said, "Yeah, I'm okay, dad." And he didn't believe me. And he asked me again, "Are you okay?" And I said, yeah, I'm okay. You know, just hearing the words ringing in my ears that whatever you do, don't tell your mom and dad. And I lied to him again. I said, "Yeah, I'm okay." And he asked me a third time, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yes." And he just, you know, I still don't think he believed me, but he just turned around and he drove out. And I just remember just being just so, so terrified as we drove away. I was looking out the back to see if my abuser was coming after me. And then we drove out of the parking lot of the church. And then I don't think I told anybody about what happened for close to 20 years, even though I remembered it and I was experiencing some effects from my abuse. I kept it locked down inside because if I couldn't tell my parents, then I couldn't tell anyone.
You've shared a really important aspect of abuse, and that's the not speaking about it. I know a lot of people who are skeptical about survivor stories will say, you know, if it really happened, if it was so bad, why didn't you speak about it when it happened? And you've explained that, how it was for you. You know, don't tell your mum and dad, your abuser said, and you were scared of him. You were just a little kid. And it was the first time you lied to your dad, you said. Could you unpack that a little bit more? Can you help our listeners understand why it's so common for survivors not to speak about the abuse for years and years or decades? And sometimes they never speak about it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, imagine the most shameful thing that could ever happen to you. And imagine it as an adult. And imagine how hesitant you would be to share that with anybody. Now put yourself in the shoes of a child who doesn't particularly know what happened, but they do know that it was wrong. They do know that it was dirty. They do know that it was disgusting. And they do know that they didn't consent to it. And I knew all of those things as it happened and afterwards. And then as you grow in knowledge about what happened to you, it doesn't make it less shameful. In fact, it makes it more shameful and more broken and more terrifying. And you live kind of in this place where you desperately want to share this fear and this shame and this guilt even with people around you, because it's this hidden, invisible burden that is wreaking havoc in your life. But there's this consistent refrain that nobody will hear you, nobody cares, and if you did tell them, they wouldn't believe you. Because in some ways, all abuse survivors believe that I contributed to this in some way. I must have done something that caused this to happen to me. And there's this perpetual like cycle of lies that you go through as you walk out being a survivor of abuse before it's in the light. And in the darkness, it just festers and it gets worse and worse. And I remember as a child and then also as a teenager, and then even in my early 20s, when I would remember what happened to me, I would have a physical reaction to it. I was so disgusted by it and disgusted by myself as well, that I remember thinking about it just in a conversation with people and for no reason remembering what had happened to me. I would feel almost as if vomit was coming up my body and I was just going to vomit everywhere because I felt so disgusted. And I remember having to physically choke down that feeling and physically choke down what I felt, because I thought if I said this to somebody, they would look at me like I was disgusting, or that I wanted it. And you can see how that's the perpetual internal monologue of somebody who's been abused. How hesitant would they be to come forward, especially if they're a child? I mean, they're a child. You don't even have your own voice yet. I mean, you exist in a family and you exist in a community structure where like, you know, you're still figuring out who you are. And so to be able to share with people something so shameful is so incredibly difficult that it often takes people years. And like you said, Linda, sometimes people never share at all because they are held in that place by those lies.
Yes, there's no doubt that abuse takes many forms, but that legacy and the impact of it is a consistent theme. You talked about all those years that you held this in the dark, and now it's come to the light, and we'll talk about that shortly. But can I ask you, is there any residual legacy of the abuse that happened to you? Are there aspects of it that you'll never recover from?
Yeah, there are, absolutely. You know, there are still significant effects to this day. And as much as I think I tried to deny the legacy of the abuse I experienced for so many years, I think finally accepting that this has had an effect on me and will continue to have an effect on me for many years. And, you know, some of those impacts, some of the destructiveness has been tamed as I've been able to talk about it, and the Lord has brought healing into my life as a result of it. But I will absolutely always walk with a limp as a result of what I've experienced. You know, the consequence of the sin that was done against me will always stay with me in one form or another. You know, whether it just be being profoundly skeptical of every single person that I encounter, you know, if it be me being a hyper-protective parent of my own sons as a result of knowing what happened to me, whether it be struggling to trust and struggling to be vulnerable and open emotionally with people, they're going to stay with me. Now, like I said, the Lord can bring healing, absolutely, and he has in many ways, but there won't be a time where I'm not going to be affected by this. That's the gravity of the sin. That's the gravity of the weight that happens in abuse to people, is that you will walk with this for the rest of your life. Doesn't mean that God can't redeem it. Doesn't mean that the Lord can't use it. Doesn't mean that you can't experience a life that has joy and that there is hope and healing for you. But it will always be with you until the Lord makes all things new again. That's how it's going to be.
Thank you for explaining the impact and the long-term effect of abuse. You know, sometimes I find myself looking around at all the church people that I live, worship, and work with, and I think, how many people in our churches, or who have left our churches, are walking with a limp, as you put it? There's a lot of work is being done now in the church and in society on trying to prevent child sexual abuse happening among us now, as we should be. But we're finding that is bringing to the surface the damage that has been done over the years, the decades, that was never spoken about. It was covered up, kept in the dark all that time. And finally, thank God, these things are being brought into the light. It's courageous people like you, Ryan, telling their stories, being brave, that will help others to tell their stories of abuse, and importantly, to be believed when they do tell their stories. I want to ask you now what you would say to people who think that abuse of children and other vulnerable people happens in other churches. It doesn't happen in our church. It doesn't happen in the Lutheran church. What would you say to them?
This may sound harsh, but I mean it to maybe shock the people who believe that. You're willfully ignorant if you think that this isn't happening in the Lutheran church, but it's happening in other churches. The Lutheran church is not immune to predators and abusers. My story is one of many in the Lutheran church that of people who have been abused there in one way or another, sexually or otherwise. Their stories, just though you may not know them, doesn't negate the fact that there are predators and wolves seeking and who have abused people in the church, just like they've done it in many other churches, in the Catholic Church, in Baptist churches, in Assemblies of God churches. Like, there are predators everywhere. And so to think that somehow the Lutheran church is magically immune to that is foolishness. And to believe it, you'd need to be willfully ignorant.
You used the word predator. What does a predator look like? How would we spot one in our churches?
There are some signs, you know, that you can do the training. And if you do the child safe training within the Lutheran church or any of these child safe protective measures, they'll tell you some signs. But predators are known for being able to disguise themselves and camouflage themselves into communities and embed themselves into churches. And so they could look like anyone. And I don't say that to make everybody freak out and begin to be suspicious of every single person around them. But I do say it to let you know that a predator can look like pretty much anything. It can be a woman. It can be a man. It can be an older boy, an older girl. You know, it can be anybody can be a predator. And I think if you look at statistics and you read the stories of people who've survived abuse, they are absolutely anyone and everyone. The demographic is not limited to middle-aged men who live alone. Like, this is not the one demographic that we need to look out for. And there are signs and that you know that somebody's kind of grooming and things like that. But they're very, very good at protecting their intentions in the communities that they inhabit.
Yes, and I think that's the lesson we're starting to learn now. We're discovering that predators often don't fit our preconceived stereotypes, do they? I know that when people learn the identity of a predator, often their response is one of total shock. My goodness, I would never have expected him or her. That's the last person that I would have thought would do that. So it's been a really helpful insight that you've shared. We need to be constantly, constantly vigilant. I'd like to move on now to your experiences of when you did come forward and spoke about the abuse that happened to you. Could you share with us, first of all, what was helpful when you found the courage to speak up?
So by the grace of God, I actually had a really good experience when I first began to share about my abuse. And I'd actually moved to the States. I found myself in a church community where there was a culture of honesty. There was a culture of grace. And there was also a culture of sharing things about what had happened to us and things that we had done. There wasn't a sense of shame attached to them. There was a hope in what the gospel of Jesus Christ could do to people who'd experienced and who had participated in heinous sin as well. And so I finally found myself in a community where I felt like, man, I think I might be able to share this and not be scoffed at, ridiculed, thought less of. Maybe I'd be heard and maybe I'd be believed. And so I was actually living with a family from the church at the time. I was just living in their spare room and they were wonderful, dear brother and sister in Christ. And we were actually doing the dishes one night and I just felt like the Lord had kind of moved me to this place where he said, okay, you could share this with them. And I did. And I was heard and believed. And so they're the two major things that any victim of abuse once needs in that place is to be believed and to be heard. And so I was actually able to share that with them. And then it kind of began this process of walking through what does healing look like? What is seeking justice look like? What does forgiveness look like? And then what does reckoning with the effects of my abuse look like for me? And so, you know, I think for survivors of abuse, when they are dismissed, when they are belittled, when they are told, well, it's not really that big a deal, or I'm sure it didn't happen like that, that is profoundly, profoundly negatively impactful for them, because people don't make this stuff up. Like, if you just look at the statistics, you're in the very, very high 90% like bracket of like people who tell the truth about this, because who wants to make this stuff up? Like, you're a psychopath if you want to make this stuff up. And so for people to finally find the courage and the hope to share, and then to not be heard and not be believed, is really compounding and difficult. But if they find themselves in a place where they are heard and believed, that's the beginning of the journey to healing for them.
Thank God that he led you to a community like that, to find some people that you felt safe to speak to. That's a lesson for all of us right there, isn't it? So take us through what happened after that, after you talked about the abuse for the first time. That's a huge step. And I'm guessing you found yourself then in a strange new place.
But like, this was not quick in any sense of that. I shared and I felt like, man, I was heard and I was believed. It began the process of about 10 years of healing. And so over the coming years, I began to just learn more and read more. And I mean, I'm a pastor myself now. And so as I was counseling with people who had been abused, I began to see a lot of my own brokenness in their brokenness, and began to want to learn more about that. And eventually I found myself sitting on the couch of a sexual abuse counselor. And he was a Christian guy who had been trained to help people walk through the pain of abuse with the lens of the Word of God and the lens of the gospel. And I remember our first session, he asked me, this is the question, Ryan, that we're going to need to answer. Where was God in the midst of your abuse? And, you know, we just began that journey of just kind of talking and engaging and beginning to think about the effects and the impact of the abuse. And then the Lord was working in the midst of that. He was working in my heart. He was working in my mind. And he was drawing me to a place where I just remember we had this one moment in the counseling session where I felt, and you know, feelings are interesting things, but we were talking about the abuse that had happened. And I just felt like the Lord met me in that place. And I got to see his utter rage against the evil that I endured. And then his profound mercy for me in the midst of it. And those things coexisting in perfect 100% harmony with one another, that he is outraged at the brokenness and the sin and the impact of this other person's sin against me, while at the same time his heart breaking for me and his mercy and grace being present with me in the midst of that. And then from that moment, I began to kind of walk out with this new picture of what it meant to heal. And then over the period of the next couple of years, I began to think about, well, what does justice now look like, right? Like, forgiveness does not negate the pursuit of justice. Grace does not negate consequence. And so eventually the opportunity to make a report against my abuser came up, and I consented to that and began to walk through the criminal side of things, because what happened to me was also a crime, and walked through that with a South Australian police detective and provided an affidavit and a statement and walked with him for many, many months through a process. But sadly, with most historical child sexual abuse claims, there's enough evidence to make an arrest, but there's not enough evidence to convict and prosecute. And so the burden of proof is extremely high for these crimes, because there's no physical evidence whatsoever, even though it's abundantly clear that my abuser had not only abused me, but many other children at that time. I was able to, you know, just trust the Lord that justice will be done. And justice will be done at the cross, or justice will be done on the final day, but justice is his. And forgiveness looks like me giving up my right to vengeance against my abuser, but not my right to the pursuit of justice. And so healing for me was both personal, but then it also had very practical outplays as they did that. And then as the criminal investigation came to an end, and as that kind of case closed, I began to think about, well, I'd found out that the pastors of the church knew that this guy had abused children for many years, actually, before and many years after. And he had abused multiple children in the same community, both in the school community and in the church community. And then these multiple cases of abuse were known by the pastors and the principal at the church. And they chose not to report, and they chose to go a different route that allowed him to continue to abuse boys like me. And I felt like that needed to be made known to the Lutheran Church. And so I consulted with a lawyer in South Australia. I was like, hey man, like I'm not here for a money grab. I'm not here to bring about any, you know, I don't want this to find its way to the front page of the Advertiser. I want the church to know, because I believe in Christian community, we have a standard that Christ has set for us, that if you have something against your brother, go to him first. And so I know that it's not just an individual thing, but kind of conscience bound. I was like, I need to go to the Lutheran Church, but I don't want to just write an email. I don't want to do that. It needs to come with a bit more of a weighty backing. And this lawyer said, hey man, we can do that. Or there's this thing called the National Redress Scheme that has been established for victims of institutional sexual abuse. And I felt like the redress scheme allowed me to have a third party kind of vet my claim and then bring it to the LCA so that they could rightly understand it. And then we could work from there. And so that's what I did. I put in a claim with the National Redress Scheme that brought this to light for the Lutheran Church of Australia.
You spoke about the National Redress Scheme. This was one of the outcomes of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse here in Australia. A number of our listeners may not be familiar with how that scheme works, and most of our listeners probably wouldn't know anyone who has lodged an application for redress. Could you explain to us how it works and what the experience was like for you?
Yeah, so the redress scheme kind of protects the person lodging the appeal, which is a wonderful thing to do. And they should. So they protect their identity, they protect who they are, they protect them from this institution, because it's a weighty thing to say, I was abused at your institution and you bear a degree of responsibility for it. And so it really took to the end of that process where it was thoroughly investigated. It took close to a year actually to go through the redress scheme process. They investigate my claims. They talk to the Lutheran Church. They compare notes. And then ultimately an independent decision maker makes a decision about the validity of my appeal. And in my case, which made sense to me, it was found in my favor, which was just another moment of relief that I was heard and believed. So that was really important. And then coming out of it, you're entitled to a direct personal response from the institution. And that can actually, like, the victim and the survivor gets to decide what that is. It can be as simple as like, hey, you know, plant a tree for me, make a donation to this charity, write me a letter. But for me, I just felt like the Lord had placed a burden on my heart that I wanted to go face to face with somebody, a representative from the Lutheran Church. And I wanted to share with them the effect that the abuse had had on me. I wanted to share with them the fact that both the criminal investigation and the civil investigation had turned up multiple other victims of this abuser at this place over many, many years, and that there were other people like me out there that needed to be engaged with, that needed to be helped, that needed to know that if they came forward, they'd be heard and believed as well, because I had been. And so I actually requested a direct personal response. I was contacted by the Professional Standards Department, who said, hey, we're going to try and organize this. And so they brought in a conciliator, somebody who was a third party, to help navigate that. And then I was actually able to sit down with the South Australia Northern Territory District Bishop, David Altus, last year. And we spent about 4 hours together discussing the impact of my abuse, what had happened to me, and then also talking about, you know, the steps that the Lutheran Church has put in place today to help mitigate the likelihood of abuse, and then to also create a place where if abuse were to happen, here's the policies and procedures that would need to be followed so that it wouldn't be able to be perpetuated and kept in the dark, kind of brushed under the rug or pushed into the dark by the pastors or the principals or the leaders who didn't want the bad press or who didn't want to bring this out to light, who didn't want to deal with this in a godly manner.
You said you sat down with Bishop David Altus to speak about your experience. I knew about that in advance of this interview, as it turns out. So I was able to ask him if it's okay with him to ask you this question. And he said, sure. So I'm going to ask you, what was that experience like for you?
When I sat down with David, I was just blessed. It was the Lord's kindness. I was able to share the impact of my abuse, the perpetual impact, the impact for me as a child, the impact for me as a young man, the damage it had done in my life and in my relationships, the depression and the anxiety, the mental health issues that had come from this experience, how it had driven me and kind of robbed me of so much of my childhood and my life, how this one place that felt safe to me now was gone. And there was no place that felt safe to me. And as I shared that with David, he was able to meet me there. And the thing that I respect the most is that he didn't explain away. He didn't make excuses. He didn't say, well, that wouldn't happen again today. He repented like a good Christian man should. Like a man who's responsible. Now, he's not personally responsible for everything that happened to me, but as a representative of the organization, as a representative of the church, he just believed the gospel that he could own the sin of the past and that he was not going to be held to that standard, but that he could understand that I could look him in the eye and I could say, I forgive you for the way that this organization has failed me and has failed other boys. And has left us to be used by an abuser. And I can look you in the eye and I can say, Christ has forgiven me such a great sin. All of my sin has been forgiven by Christ. How then can I hold anything against you? And I think beginning at that place of repentance, where excuses weren't made, and that he was able to say, we have sinned against you, both in what we have done and what we have failed to do. And we want to walk this out in a biblical manner. Gave me great confidence. And from there, he wanted to press forward with, well, what does restitution look like now? Knowing that there were other victims of abuse, I'd expressed a desire that, could you please let the congregation know that this happened and that there were other people who were abused as well, so that they too might be able to find hope and healing and restoration? And he said, yeah, not only will I just go to that congregation, I want to go to the whole district. And I want to let them know what has happened. And so an announcement was made at the congregation where I was abused. It was put in their newsletter over multiple weeks so that all of their members would know. And then he was actually able to publish it in the Together magazine, which goes out to the South Australia Northern Territory District, just a couple of months after the announcement was made. And so not only did he say, well, I'm not only going to go there, but I want to go further just so other people know that we're serious about this. And we want to make sure that if there are survivors, that they know that there are multiple avenues for them to seek help and healing, both within the church and both outside of the church. How might they go ahead to seek their own healing journey?
That's extraordinarily powerful and helpful. We so often hear only the negative responses when people like you come forward with their accounts of abuse. So thank you for sharing the experience you had with Bishop David, and thank you to Bishop David himself for the way he responded and giving us that fantastic example of how to care for abuse survivors in a Christ-like manner. Moving on from that conversation with Bishop David, I wonder if you have any guidelines or principles that could help our wider church community and each of us as individuals to create a culture of vigilance and of zero acceptance of child abuse among us.
Yeah, I think it begins with culture. Church cultures are just notoriously fickle. Notoriously filled with hypocrisy and a facade of godliness, while at the same time, sin is utterly destroying the foundations of the church. And that's what happened at the church that I was at. You know, it was, we're going to push all of this into the closet. We're going to just close the door and we're going to just keep carrying on like everything's fine and everything's good and that it's all great. And the Lord sees, like he is not unable to see what's in the closet, right? And he has committed to bringing what is in the dark out to the light. And he's going to do it. And he might do it 25 years later, like he did for me, or he might do it in that moment because he is more concerned with the integrity of his church than he is with your standing in your community. He's more concerned with the purity of his bride than he is about you having a good reputation among other Christians or you looking like you've got it all together. Like, you know, we read about the Pharisees, right? Like Jesus calls them whitewashed tombs. You've got dead men's bones. You look good on the outside, but you're dead on the inside. Lord, make it not so in our churches. Let us be okay to know that you are the one who will deal with our reputations and you are the one who will stand ultimately before and give an account. And so as we think about that, that makes us serious about abuse. We don't look at abuse and think, man, this is something to be managed. We look at it and we say, no, we're going to bring all that is in the dark into the light because the Lord already sees. And if we can believe that and walk in that, then I think maybe our churches have a hope and a future. But if we continue to try to manage our sin, man, the Lord is just going to bring us to destruction and rightfully so. I mean, I read in the book of Amos, right? Like how the Lord's people were kind of putting on a show. They were holding the feasts and they were acting like they were all good. But God speaks to them and he says this in Amos 5. He says, I despise your feasts and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fattened animals, I will not look upon them. Take away from me the noise of your songs. To the melody of your harps, I will not listen. And then this is what the prophet says, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Like if you want to know God's heart is with the victim. God's heart is with the broken and the maligned and the suffering amongst us. God's heart sees them and he breaks for them. And when power seeks to cover up and power seeks to protect power, he wants nothing to do with that. And in our churches, it's the worst place because our churches should be the place where we say you can bring your worst and Christ loves you still. And you're no longer seen as that. And you can be redeemed from all of your brokenness. And I think when we can begin to hold those values and we can begin to see as Christ sees, our churches will become healthy places. Our churches will become places where we're beginning to talk about this. And when we begin to talk about it, I think those who would be seeking to do that evil amongst us, they see there's no place for them. Now, policy and procedure, super important. And they come out of that heart, do they not? But ultimately, if we can create a culture where this is just not like it's nothing's hidden, then I think we'll begin to get to the heart of what God wants to see in his churches, which is people who say, yes, we're great sinners, but we have been greatly loved and we have been greatly forgiven by a great Savior. And when we understand that, we keep that central to everything that we are and everything that we believe, then we will begin to see a church community where vulnerable people are protected, where the most innocent amongst us are protected from evil people. And we can begin to see a healthy place and a healthy community for people to grow up in the fear and admonition of the Lord.
Ryan, I had one last question, but I'm not going to ask it because I want to end this conversation right there with your resounding call to seek God's love, God's mercy, God's justice. And with that call of the gospel to bring whatever is in darkness into the light. So thank you for your great gift to us in sharing your story and God's story.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you.
If this podcast has prompted you to speak to someone about the abuse that's happened to you in our church, or to make a complaint, or to make a report to the police, you'll find information for how to do that on our podcast's webpage. You'll also find there information about the LCANZ Safe Church Training Program and child safety standards for congregations. Go to www.lca.org.au/podcasts and look for this podcast, where we've attached information that we hope will help you.